Welcome to the brightest audience in the nation to the Bob Enyart Live February Telethon. During our telethon this month, we're offering a free gift, Bob's video series, Having a Great Prayer Life, when you become a new subscriber to any of our monthly subscriptions. Our newest product, our monthly sermon audios on standard compact disc, allows you to listen to the sermon on any CD player, including the one in your car. You can also get the monthly sermons on MP3 CD, or you can get the video version of the monthly sermon videos on DVD. Bob's monthly Bible studies are now available on DVD or MP3 CD. These are great for starting your own family Bible study or a neighborhood Bible study. And Bob's monthly topical videos give you a new topical video each month, and with the best of Bob, you can get the best 8 Bob Enyart Live shows every month. By becoming a new subscriber to any of Bob's monthly products, making a new monthly donation of $20 or more, or a one-time donation of $50, you'll receive the video series, Having a Great Prayer Life, free of charge, special this month for the Bob Enyart Live February Telethon.
One morning, there's truth overhead. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with the weak.
Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, we got a lot to cover. We have a short audio clip from Aaron Ra we'll talk about later in the show. We'll play it. That's the debate we're on in a website over in England called League of Reason. That'll be fun. And what else are we going to do? We're going to have a second-year college student at a local engineering school join us for his opinion on how the debate is going so far. That'll be great. Mark will be in here in a moment. And that's going to be interesting. Mark will admit to having a bias. That's true. But still, I'd like to get from a young person what they think about it. And then you've got an email from a listener to Real Science Friday. And I'd like to ask you about weight. I've felt a heavy weight on me lately, Fred.
You felt a heavy weight. Was it air?
As a matter of fact, it was.
It was air. Well, you know, it turns out that air, there's like 22 tons of air pressure on us every second.
No.
Yes.
22 tons?
22 tons. You know, air actually has weight. If you take two balloons on either side of a hanger and you fill one full of air, guess which side of the hanger tips?
Oh, the one full of air.
You got it.
So air is heavy.
Yes.
I had a high school general science teacher show us that. He had a scale. And he had a glass jar on it, and he put a cork in the top, and he pumped air out of the bottle, and sure enough, the scale, it was showing that the bottle's lighter and lighter. Then he said, well, one of the students said, could you reverse it? And he said, sure. He reversed the pump. The bottle started getting heavier and heavier until it exploded, and about half a dozen of us got cut with flying glass.
Oh, really? But I bet you're all cheering, right?
Well,
you know, that's what guys do. They blow things up and they yell and scream.
Like, whoa! Cool, look at this. And what do you call this? This is red. It's hemoglobin. It's got air in that hemoglobin. Yeah. So anyway, 22 tons of air on us.
Yeah. And so how do we not get crushed under all this tremendous weight?
That's interesting because even a fish under the sea has, especially the ones that are deep water creatures, have tremendous pressure on them, yet they seem perfectly comfortable. How does it happen?
Yeah, so is there maybe an equal amount of pressure exerted on all sides? So like in our case, we've got air in our lungs, right? Yeah, so we are full of air. I know that some of our listeners would think that. Well, it's true, we are. So there's an equal, essentially an equal amount of pressure. Is this like when you lift a TV set, it's got air hitting it on all sides, right? Mm. So it equals out, so we're really only lifting the weight of the TV.
Because the air underneath the TV would effectively be pushing it up. And understanding that and the physics of that is one way to get an airplane off the ground. An airplane might weigh many tons, but understanding air pressure and because of the curvature of the wings, you've got more air pressure beneath per square inch than you have on top because there's more surface space on top of the wing. And so the airplane goes up in the air.
Yeah. Well, what happens, Bob, if we sent you up into space, into outer space?
I'd die.
You would die pretty quickly.
Yeah.
first of all, the air in your lungs would expand to take up all the empty space, and then water, boils at a lower temperature.
It's an ugly picture. Fred.
It is. I guess the dogs they sent up in space picture. In the early 60s, they survived. I think it was about 90 seconds is about how long you can last. So it's not
sad.
A pretty picture.
No, that's sad.
I don't know if you saw the end of that Total Recall.
No.
Did you ever see that movie? I'm looking at our
college student.
Yeah, that we're going to bring in to talk about the hot air.
But
speaking
of
air,
I haven't seen that. But at the end of it,
well, they're exposed to Mars, with the vacuum of space essentially, and their faces all shriveling up, and it's totally sensationalized, but it's not pretty. Mm.
So I'm glad that we're made in such a way that in this world we live in, we could enjoy our existence, one another. Enjoy the world and looking at the whole universe. It's so fun to be alive.
Yep, that's right.
There are difficulties, but we have to deal with those. Okay, how about the email? And then I can't wait to get to our guest. How about
we got an email from a regular listener, I guess, to our show in Florida. His name's Isaac, and he really offered what I thought was a real interesting dichotomy on two issues. So,
Hi, Isaac.
Hello, Isaac. So he thought it'd be interesting for us to ponder on what we thought of biogenesis and abortion, two opposite sides of the spectrum.
Oh, huh.
We've got that something, amino acids, represent life, and yet it's not a living cell. And then if you look at something that is full of cells, such as a fetus, a baby in the womb, it's not life, but a blob of tissue.
Oh, brother.
What an interesting dichotomy.
This is so interesting. Fred, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science... And the curator there, Captain Kirk, we fondly refer to him as Captain Kirk because he doesn't know if he exists, he said. He has an exhibit there, and it talks about the Miller-Urey experiments. Remember that?
Yeah, they tried to create life in the lab.
1953. Yeah. They synthesized amino acids.
They did. The building blocks of life.
The building blocks of physical life, biological life. That's not life. It's amino acids. There are plenty of amino acids. It's not life.
It's not.
It's amino acids. So at the exhibit at the museum, it said this, was life created in the lab with a question mark? And I'm thinking, okay, here we are almost 60 years later. You guys haven't figured out if you created life in the lab yet? It's 60 years later. You didn't make life. You made amino acids. But Fred, I think Isaac's got a brilliant point. They say that life was created in the lab, but a baby in the womb with millions of cells, each cell with his DNA, and he's alive, he's growing, and they say, we don't know if that's life.
Yeah, that's just a blob of tissue. So was the Miller experiment, was that really life, though? So they have these amino acids. Now, the amino acids in a living thing, aren't they all in the same direction? They have a handedness to it. They call it chirality?
Yeah, it's like a hockey stick is either right or left-handed. We have three hockey players currently in our household. So if you have a right or left hockey stick, well, molecules, some are right or left-handed. And with amino acids, they're either right or left. And in nature, they're 50-50, but not in
living. Yeah, they're randomized, right? Yeah. In living things, they're all left-handed?
Yeah, virtually all left-handed amino acids.
And when something dies, don't they start to randomize again?
It sure does. And so it turns out that in dinosaur fossils, and Fred, this has been documented by the Royal Society for the Advancement of Science, whatever, in England. They said, we looked at these dinosaur shells, and the amino acids were not 50-50 randomized. They're left-handed. Why are they left-handed? This dinosaur egg, they think, is 65 million years old. Why aren't they all 50-50 by now? Because they start to decompose.
Yeah, exactly. They decompose, and they start to get back into the random.
And we know why,
half and half.
Because the dinosaur egg is not 65.
It's not 65 million years old.
And that's just yet another piece of evidence. So I think that's a great point that Isaac has brought up. The difference, how your worldview, you'll see a baby in the womb literally sucking its thumb and playing with its toes. And you'll say, well, we don't know when human life begins. But they got acids in a test tube, and they'll say, we created life in the lab.
It's amazing. Yeah, they use the word life.
All right. Now, Mark is here, and let's welcome Mark Bernhardt to the studio. Mark, welcome to Real Science Friday. It's great to have you in studio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Mark, you are a sophomore at a local engineering school.
Yeah, School of Mines.
School of Mines. That's prestigious, I think. Fred, didn't you go to a School of Mines?
I went to the Missouri School of Mines. They ended up changing it to University of Missouri at Rolla. But yeah, School of Mines. And yeah, the Colorado School of Mines is an excellent institution. Excited to hear your perspective on this debate.
Yeah. Mark, before the debate, you said you're not a neutral observer to the debate we're having with Aaron Ra, this very well-known atheist.
Right.
You're not neutral, but I wanted to hear your impression on how it's going. We talked to Aaron Ra on the radio back in November, and just a few weeks ago, we started a written debate. We're now up to round three. So what do you think?
Well, my initial thought was just the intellectual dishonesty that Aaron is showing through his method of debate kind of struck me. I can say that I'm a Christian, but I have had friends in the past and even people that I've observed, atheists and evolutionists that I've observed, that I would say, you know, I respect and I admire.
When you talk to them and if they're intellectually honest when you're talking to them,
right,
then there's something to grab onto there. That's pretty neat.
And I feel I've learned a lot from just their perspectives that they've conveyed to me. And and that's one thing that Aaron isn't really showing me. He's not really, I mean, he's saying a lot of definite statements about the debate. He's not pulling up any actual references too. That's another thing that I've found.
Yeah, like who would have guessed before the debate started, which of the atheists and evolutionists over in England on League of Reason, which of them would have thought that the creationist would be posting all links to refereed scientific journals and the atheist evolutionist would just be giving his opinion? I don't think they would have guessed that the debate would go that way.
Right, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing, and that just goes to show you that when you don't have the truth on your side, it's a lot harder to argue rationally. And because rationality itself has truth in it. And you know, when you defy reason and such, you know, it's hard to hold an argument.
Now, Mark, you come across very well on the radio. I could tell right off the bat. I hate to ask you a personal question, but are you engaged or anything? Because there's going to be women listening to this thinking, now, what's his name and where does he live? Are you? I don't know. Are you?
No, I'm not.
All right.
He's actually got a face for TV. I have the face for radio.
Yeah, Fred and I both are made for radio, and Mark is for TV. So
I don't know
so,
about that.
Okay, so, Mark, the frustration that I feel, I'd like to take on Aaron Ra's strongest arguments.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But on the simplest things, when there is no meeting of the minds, it's so difficult to take his claim seriously. I'd like to hear maybe a couple examples from you. We have audio about a very simple issue about Isaac Newton. Aaron Ra said that the vast majority of scientists are evolutionists. So I said, you know, Aaron, I agree with that, but I'd like to offer some counter evidence. Because many of the greatest scientists believe that God created in the recent past or that Darwinism is not true. And many scientists today believe that. So while most are evolutionists, truth is not determined by democracy in a vote. So I mentioned Isaac Newton and others who are creationist scientists who were creationists, and he didn't like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I was talking about. You know, he's just dishonest in that, and the way he refuted it was just very weak in my perspective. You know, he didn't once quote anything that was said. He even admitted to not having read any of Newton's works, significant works.
Right, and I linked to Newton's writings and I pasted from Newton into the debate. So I said, Aaron, here's what Isaac Newton believed. And so we know, but he still resisted and rejected. But
right.
Let's hear this clip, Fred. This is from back in November on Real Science Friday with Aaron Ra. Before Darwin, those who affirmed a special creation by God, Copernicus and Francis Bacon and Kepler and William Harvey and Pascal and Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Cuvier,
you have to clarify
John Dalton.
Also again.
Yeah.
Most of the people that you're talking about, since they predate the creationism movement, wherein they reject methodological naturalism, you can't call them creationists. Everybody, practically everybody, believed in a God once upon a time. But that doesn't mean that they reject natural explanations. Do you throw Newton out there? No, Newton did not reject natural explanations.
No, maybe we're misunderstanding one another. I'm not saying that Isaac Newton didn't believe that the laws of science, the laws of physics were real and that we could study them. I'm saying that Isaac Newton, for example, wrote more about the Bible and theology than he did about physics and math. Newton committed his life to the teachings of the Bible, to affirming the chronology of the Bible, and to Christian theology as he could study it in the scriptures. And so can't claim that Isaac Newton believed in secular origins. He believed that the God of the Bible created, even based on the timing that we find, at least superficially, in the book of Genesis. Isaac Newton wrote an entire book on that subject, trying to correlate the Egyptian dynasties with biblical history as it is in the scriptures. So you'd have to say he's on our side.
I can't say that Newton was a creationist in the sense that you have modern creationists when there's a point of division wherein you have natural explanations for something that heretofore did not have.
Well, how about this? In that Isaac Newton rejected Descartes' idea that the solar system formed by a condensing gas cloud, a spinning nebula, and he believed that the Earth was created, just like Johann Kepler did, about 6,000 years earlier by God, as stated in Genesis. That's what Isaac Newton not only believed, but he wrote extensively to try to persuade people that that was true. So can't you agree, at least on that? We have some common ground. Can't you agree?
We have to have, remember, there's two definitions for creationism. One, you have to reject evolution, which Newton didn't know anything about. It had never been presented. And two, he would have to reject methodological naturalism, which clearly he did not.
Isaac Newton would not have had to know about genetics to reject the notion that the sun and the earth were created 6,000 years earlier. Darwin has nothing to do, including Darwinism, has nothing to do with Isaac Newton's...
There's no such thing as Darwinism.
Okay. Anyway, so you can't agree that Isaac Newton, because he affirmed a 6,000-year earth and that we were specially created by God as man and woman in the Garden of Eden, you can't agree that that means Isaac Newton took our side. You can't agree with that.
I can't say that Isaac Newton would have rejected evidence in favor of a priori doctrinal obligation.
All right. So, Mark, why don't you and I talk, Fred is just boiling over there, but why don't you and I talk through that? Just trying to understand what's going on in a conversation like that.
Yeah, I mean, again, the logical fallacies that he makes there are just ridiculous because, you know, truth shouldn't be relative to a situation or, you know, a time period. Mm. You know, you look at the path to truth, and there's all these inputs, and over time, you know, you're going to have more and more inputs. And so that's right. What he's kind of saying with the, you know, the modern
right.
view of evolution has changed a lot.
So you go back to the ancient Greeks, and many of them believed that the universe was eternal, that it didn't have an origin. So Isaac Newton, who was very educated in the classics and Greeks and the ancient, he wrote a book on the ancient kingdoms of the world in order to prove that the chronology of the Bible is true. That was the point of his book. He could have easily said, no, the universe has always been here. He could have said that. Or
right.
he could have said that Descartes was right, that the sun and the planets must have formed naturally. Instead, he said they could not have formed naturally. I quoted in round one of this debate, I linked to and quoted from the Newton Project, Isaac Newton's own words, where he said that gravity would not result in the sun and the planets in our configuration. It could only be by God.
So a question I'd like to ask Aaron Raw is, was Darwin an evolutionist?
Was,
you know, because he's not a modern evolutionist, so
well,
he must not have been an evolutionist.
Aaron Raw, you couldn't say Darwin was an evolutionist. You couldn't say he was a Darwinist. And that's if right. you said, you couldn't say he's a neo-Darwinist for sure.
That's
so,
right.
I think it's immature. I think what we're seeing is an intellectual tantrum. And why that would be, why would you come up with a definition of a creationist such that the world's many science historians believe Isaac Newton was the greatest scientist who ever lived? Often that's asserted by science historians. So to come up with a definition of a creationist that would exclude Isaac Newton as a creationist is an intellectual temper tantrum, I think.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah.
As you're following the debate, Mark, and you're reading, is it fulfilling to you that we have an opponent who behaves that way?
Well, and see, that's the thing is I really enjoy debates, especially yours. You know, in the past when you debated Zekith, I felt like I got a lot more out of that one because I felt, for the most part, he had better arguments that actually had substance to them. And that's what I look for. You know, I'm not biased in the sense that I'm not open-minded. I'm extremely open-minded. I would love to be proven wrong. That's the point of life for me, is to search for the truth. Mm-hmm. And it's going to, you know, until the day I die, I'm going to be searching for the truth.
When an atheist comes and says, look, we could prove from these tree rings that the chronology in the Bible is wrong, I'm all over that. I'm like, well, show me. I'd like to see the evidence to consider whether you can establish that I'm wrong or not, because I've been persuaded that the Bible is God's word and that the earth is young. But let's see the evidence. I want to see it. It seems like the atheist, like Aaron Ross said about dinosaur tissue, he said, there is no biological dinosaur tissue. There is no soft tissue, and even if there were, it wouldn't matter at all to our debate.
Right.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I was just going to say that in regards to that soft tissue find, I was looking over the 60 Minutes interview on that, and it was just interesting to me to see how Mary Schweitzer, when she said they discovered that, they were shocked, obviously. They were shocked, and they...
For dinosaurs to have original biological material, they think they're 60 to 150 million years old.
Right.
So that's pretty shocking to find blood vessels and cells.
And it was just, it struck me as ironic that original biological material could last millions of years. And she would rather that, you know, change their view of modern science than even to even suggest the notion that, you know, that the Earth could be
young. That maybe dinosaurs did not live 65 million years ago. Now, Fred, I find it interesting that Aaron Ra keeps saying that he read Schweitzer's paper, that this is not biological tissue from dinosaurs, because he read Schweitzer's paper.
I don't know what point he's making. He's trying to make it seem impressive that he read her paper.
Yeah, well,
does she think in the paper?
Well, she thinks it's dinosaur tissue.
Yeah.
Now, there was a paper published in 2008 that said, you know what? We think it's not dinosaur tissue. We think it's bacteria.
And we've reviewed that paper, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not shabby work. It's actually...
It
was well thought out.
Yeah, I've read that paper, and they're saying, look, dinosaur fossils can have bacteria in them. So maybe what Schweitzer is finding, and Harvard and the University of North Carolina and Montana State and dozens of universities now, maybe what they're finding is bacteria. So it's worth considering, but it turns out that there is powerful evidence that it's not bacteria they're finding, it's dinosaur tissue.
Yeah.
From the proteins that they're sequencing.
So the protein sequences, were they reptilian or form of bacteria, reptilia?
Yeah. It turns out that when they sequence proteins, they're able to map them onto proteins from living organisms that are extant, alive today, and they're from reptiles, which is what we would expect. And Fred, so
is there a reptilian bacteria life form on the moon?
Well, what's interesting is the papers from Mary Schweitzer and Jack Horner and so many others, including papers that are not from them at all, that are from other universities in Europe and around America, saying, look, we're finding soft tissue. Here's what we're finding from dinosaurs, hadrosaurs and mosasaurs, a marine reptile, and Archaeopteryx and all. Here's what it is. And when they report, they say, and you know what else we found? We also found bacteria. They say that. They say we found bacteria, but that's not what we're excited about. We're excited about finding the dinosaur tissue that we're sequencing the proteins, and the right kind of proteins are appearing in the right place in the dinosaur fossils where we find these tissues.
Yeah, the evidence is so overwhelming. The 2008 paper has pretty much been thoroughly refuted. That argument is gone. I don't think you'll see another presentation such as that, because there's major universities now. We're not talking, you know, the little sisters of the poor. We're talking Harvard and many other leading institutions.
University of Pennsylvania, Manchester, literally from schools all over the U.S., prestigious schools with major science departments. Even just able to do this work is stunning. And you know, one thing, the 2008 paper that said the dinosaur and tissue is from bacterial biofilm, that was peer-reviewed and it was published. And they said, we don't think it's dinosaur tissue because, you know, that's just impossible to be around. I mean, we look at Egyptian mummies and we can see the state of decay in the most fabulous conditions for preservation. And we see that the biological molecules deteriorate rapidly within thousands of years.
And I tell you, this really is an impressive argument, Bob. And I haven't shared with you the story, but I gave a talk at our church about 2 weeks ago to the youth, a sixth grade class. And there was a boy in there, and he was just shaking his head when I was talking about dinosaurs being alive at the same time man was, and that dinosaurs aren't millions of years old. He wasn't only shaking his head, he was telling the kid next to him that this is baloney and we shouldn't be listening to this. This is just wrong. Well, when I got to the part about the soft tissue, I singled him out, and, you know, politely, and I says, "Now I realize you disagree, and I understand that. We should always have caution and question things that we hear.
Sure.
But I wanted to show you the next few slides on soft tissue and the fact of what we've discovered. And this is out of major secular sources,
like
MSNBC.
Science, yeah. And the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
And I showed him
Plus the, One,
yes,
and so on.
I showed him these pictures, and his eyes got really big. And this is his exact words. He said, "This changes everything." And he was kind of quiet the rest of
this
the talk.
This changes
everything. This changes everything. He was like just blown away by this.
Fred, I was talking to a friend of mine at Starbucks today named Sean, and a college student was sitting across from us. And I was telling Sean, I showed him the pictures of this soft tissue dinosaur. And I said, and there's carbon-14 in it, and carbon-14 cannot last millions of years, only thousands because of the decay rate. And this college student said, no, that's not true. It depends on how it's encased. It could last longer. And I said, that's not true. This is a nuclear process, and it doesn't matter the temperature, the pressure. It's going to decay. It doesn't matter if it's in sandstone or in bone or in a plant. It's going to decay at a steady rate. Stop the tape. Stop the tape. Hi, this is Bob Enyart interrupting my own show. I've just somewhat overstated my case, so I want to be more accurate and, of course, not spread misinformation. Yes, there have been experiments over the years showing that we can chemically induce small changes in decay rates, for example, of beryllium-7, but those kinds of changes are tiny, and there is no known decay rate phenomenon that would help an old earther explain away carbon-14 in dinosaur fossils. Also, my favorite author, Dr. Walt Brown, in his book In the Beginning, has a tremendous chapter on the origin of Earth's radioactivity. That chapter, I've read it repeatedly, I highly recommend it. And it discusses decay rates, the physics of altering elements, and introducing radioactivity. And Dr. Brown discusses how, in a perfect world, a paradise created without radioactivity, which is so dangerous, how radioactivity originated on Earth. And his explanation, supported by repeatable scientific experiments and by many observations, also goes a long way toward explaining the contradictory results that frustrate even old Earth geologists when they radiometrically date things and they come out with very contradictory results. Walt Brown's chapter on radioactivity helps explain that. Now, none of this, however, will help the person who is trying to explain why we find a lot of C14 worldwide, ubiquitously, everywhere it shouldn't be, like in petrified wood, coal, oil, limestone. We find it everywhere. Graphite, natural gas, in amber, marble, dinosaur fossils, and even in supposedly billion-year-old diamonds. So I don't want to overstate the case. Yes, there is some variation in decay rates. Experimentally, decay rates have been known to change, but the change is either insignificant or in the wrong direction, so that it will not help an old earther explain modern carbon in dinosaur fossils. To be more clear, there is nothing about the chemical environment on Earth or about the pressures and temperatures on the crust of the Earth that could slow down the carbon-14 decay rate to explain its presence everywhere we look. And now, back to the program. Mark, we're about out of time, but Aaron Ra, it would be interesting if he would try to point to refereed scientific journals to make his claim that the soft tissue from dinosaurs has been refuted.
Absolutely. I mean, he needs to do that at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, the ball's in his court. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward to the rest of the debate.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Fred Williams, thank you. I can't wait, Fred, to see what he does. It's going to be fascinating.
That's right. Looking forward to it.
All right. And our website, realsciencefriday.com, and we have great science resources, DVDs, books, debates, all there. And if you get them, you help with the show and you help us with our telethon. This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.